Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, November the 24th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled Ceasefire Set to Begin, has to do with the Israeli-Hamas war. First hostages in Gaza to be freed, Palestinian toll tops 13,300. A four-day ceasefire in Gaza between Israel and Hamas was set to begin Friday morning, Qatar said after a day-long delay extended the agony for those hoping for some relief from the deal, which is to bring the release of dozens of hostages held by militants and Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. The diplomatic breakthrough promised some relief for the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza who have endured weeks of Israeli bombardment, as well as families in Israel fearful for the fate of their loved ones taken captive during Hamas's October the 7th attack that triggered the war. The ceasefire was originally set to begin Thursday morning, but it appeared to hit a snag the night before when Israel's national security advisor, Tzaki Hagevi, announced a one-day delay without providing a reason. On Thursday, Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesman Majed Al Ansari announced the ceasefire will start at 7 a.m. local time Friday, 5 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time. He said the two sides had exchanged lists of those to be released, and the first group of 13 women and children held by Hamas would be freed Friday afternoon. He did not say how many Palestinian prisoners would be freed, but officials have said three would be freed for every hostage. Increased aid for Palestinians will start to enter Gaza as soon as possible, Ansari said. The hope is that the momentum from this deal will lead to an end to this violence, he told reporters. Israeli airstrikes continued Thursday. In the afternoon, a strike leveled a residential building in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. At least 12 people were killed, according to officials at nearby Al-Aqsa Hospital. One resident, Hosni Moharib, said his wife and several children were killed and other relatives remained buried under the rubble. It exploded on the house, striking the babies and young children. Everyone in the house, they are all dead, he said, bursting into tears. The Israeli bombardment, now in its seventh week, has killed more than 13,300 Palestinians, according to the health ministry in Hamas-ruled Gaza, which resumed its detailed count of casualties in Gaza from the war. The ministry had stopped publishing casualty counts since November the 11th, saying it had lost the ability to do so because of the health system's collapse in the north. The new numbers were not fully broken down, but women and minors have consistently made up around two-thirds of the dead. The figures do not include updated numbers from hospitals in the north. The ministry says some 6,000 people have been reported missing, feared buried under the rubble. The ministry does not differentiate between civilians and militants in its death tolls. Israel says it has killed thousands of Hamas fighters without presenting evidence for its count. The truce agreement raised hopes of eventually winding down the war, which has leveled vast swaths of Gaza, fueled a surge of violence in the occupied West Bank, and stirred fears of a wider conflagration across the Middle East. Air raid sirens sounded across northern Israel on Thursday as Hezbollah said it fired 48 Katyushik rockets from southern Lebanon. The barrage came after an Israeli strike killed five Hezbollah fighters, including the son of the head of the group's parliamentary bloc. The Israeli military said it was striking the sources of the launches. Israel and Hezbollah, which fought a month-long war in the year 2006, have reportedly traded fire across the border since the war in Gaza broke out. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to continue the war after the truce expires to destroy Hamas's military capabilities, end its 16-year rule in Gaza, and return all the estimated 240 captives held in Gaza by Hamas and other groups. We will continue it until we achieve all our goals, Netanyahu said, saying that he had delivered the same message in a phone call to President Joe Biden. Washington has provided extensive military and diplomatic support to Israel since the start of the war. The Israeli military said combat operations would continue until it was ordered to hold fire, and Chief Spokesman Rear Admiral Dan Hagari said troops would remain in place during the truce. Israeli forces hold much of northern Gaza, where they say they have dismantled tunnels and much of Hamas's infrastructure there. The military said it has surrounded the Jabalia refugee camp and called on any residents inside to evacuate Thursday. The military has said it is pursuing Hamas fighters in Jabalia, a dense urban district adjacent to Gaza City that has been heavily bombarded for weeks. The military said Thursday it detained the director of Gaza City's Shifa Hospital, Mohammed Abu Salimia, for questioning over his involvement in what it called extensive Hamas activities in the hospital. Gaza's health ministry condemned Abu Salimia's arrest and called on the international bodies to intervene. For Hamas, the ceasefire would provide an opportunity to regroup after weeks of apparently heavy losses. Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, who is believed to be alive and in hiding in Gaza, is likely to claim the release of Palestinian prisoners as a major achievement and declare victory if the war ends. This story also from the front page of the Courier. Poll says nearly half of Americans say Ukraine spending too high. As lawmakers in Washington weigh sending billions more in federal support to Kyiv to help fight off Russian aggression, close to half of the U.S. public thinks the country is spending too much on aid to Ukraine, according to polling from the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Those sentiments, driven primarily by Republicans, help explain the hardening opposition among conservative GOP lawmakers on Capitol Hill who are rebuffing efforts from President Joe Biden to approve a new set of Ukrainian aid, arguing that the money would be better spent for domestic priorities. Yet opposition to aid is down slightly from where it was a month ago in another AP-NORC poll. Now 45% say the U.S. government is spending too much on aid to Ukraine in the war against Russia, compared with 52% in October. That shift appears to come mostly from Republicans. 59% now say too much is spent on Ukraine aid, but that's down from 69% in October. Nonetheless, the Republican resistance to continue Ukraine aid remains strong. I understand the citizens need help, but I feel like we're spending way too much money on Ukraine when we have our issues here on our own soil that we need to deal with, said Eric Mondello, age 40, from Fountain, Colorado, pointing to needs such as health care for veterans and homelessness in communities. Mondello added, I understand the U.S. has been an ally to others, but I feel like let's take care of our people first. More than one-third of U.S. adults say that current spending is about the right amount, which is up slightly from last month. Among Republicans, nearly 3 in 10 say the current spending is about right, up from 20% last month. The House has been reportedly pressing lawmakers to pass Biden's nearly $106 billion emergency spending package that he proposed in October, which includes more than $61 billion specifically for the war in Ukraine. The rest of Biden's request has aid for Israel as it battles Hamas, money for various priorities in the Indo-Pacific region, and additional resources to help manage migration at the southern border. On Ukraine, the Biden administration is increasingly warning that the well of aid is running dry. In an unannounced visit to Kyiv on Monday, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Ukraine's effort to defeat Russian forces matters to the rest of the world and pledged that U.S. support would continue for the long haul. That message was reinforced at the White House. As President Biden has said, when aggressors don't pay a price for their aggression, they'll cause more chaos and death and destruction, John Kirby, spokesman for the National Security Council, told the White House press briefing Monday. They just keep on going, and the cost and the threats to America and to the world will keep rising. But Congress has rebuffed the White House's efforts of bolstering Ukraine's support at least twice in recent months. First, it ignored a roughly $40 billion supplemental request before a September 30th funding deadline. Then last week, it passed a stopgap funding measure that keeps the government operating through early next year, but with no additional Ukraine aid. In the Senate, a small bipartisan group is working on legislation that would combine fresh Ukraine assistance with stricter border measures to address concerns from Republicans that the U.S. was focused on needs abroad at the expense of issues closer to home. a broad majority of senators remain supportive of Ukraine aid, with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, being one of the most stalwart supporters, despite the isolationist strain in his party. South Dakota Senator John Thune, the number two Republican in the Senate, said lawmakers will continue to work on the Ukraine border package over the Thanksgiving break and won't wait until mid-January, when Congress faces another government funding deadline, to act on Ukraine. The big question mark is in the House, where still new Speaker Mike Johnson, who had voted against Ukraine aid as a rank-and-file conservative, has spoken broadly of the need to counter Russian aggression, yet faces unruly GOP lawmakers who have shown more hostility to continued support for Kyiv. Johnson, too, is insisting that additional Ukraine aid be paired with tougher border measures, although it is far from certain that any immigration agreement that clears the Democratic-led Senate could pass the GOP-controlled House. Half of U.S. adults are extremely or very concerned that Russia's influence poses a direct threat to the United States. Democrats and Republicans are similarly concerned about Russian power, but Democrats are more likely than Republicans to see Ukraine as a nation of shared values to the U.S. and to support more aid for Ukraine. About half of the public endorses providing weapons to Ukraine. About 4 in 10 favor sending government funds directly to Ukraine. Americans have grown slightly more likely to say that the U.S. should take a less active role in solving the world's problems, compared with a September poll from APNORC and Pearson. Slightly fewer than half now say the U.S. should be less involved, up from 33% in September. Just 16% of Democrats now say the U.S. should take a more active role, down from 29% in September. Our next article is entitled, Can Black Friday Deals Lure Hesitant Shoppers? Retailers Fear Spending Pullback Could Temper the Holiday Season. Retailers are kicking off the unofficial start of the holiday shopping season on Friday with a bevy of discounts and other enticements. But executives are growing concerned with a spending slowdown that could temper sales on the day after Thanksgiving, as well as throughout the holidays. Shoppers, powered by a solid job market and steady wage growth, had demonstrated a resilience that confounded economists and ran counter to sour sentiments expressed in opinion polls. Such spending, while cautious, came despite higher prices in the grocery aisle and higher borrowing costs. But consumers are now coming under more pressure from dwindling savings, increased credit card debt, and still stubborn inflation. In fact, shoppers cut their buying in October, ending 6 straight months of gains. Shoppers have gotten some relief from easing inflation, but many goods and services like meat and rent are still far higher than they were just 3 years ago. The latest quarterly results from a string of retailers from Walmart to Best Buy have reported a weakening consumer. Walmart said it noticed shoppers cutting back in October and offered a muted annual sales outlook. Best Buy, the nation's largest retailer, said shoppers are trading down to cheaper TVs. And Target said shoppers are waiting longer to buy items. For example, instead of buying sweatshirts or denim back in August or September, they held out until the weather turned cold. It's clear that consumers have been remarkably resilient, Target's CEO Brian Cornell told analysts last week. Yet in our research, things like uncertainty, caution, and managing a budget are top of mind. Even luxury retailers are noting their shoppers are feeling pinched. We're taking a measured approach. There's been some softening, said Mark Metrick, CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue standalone online business Saks. I don't think the holiday season is going to be some horrible business, nor is it going to be some kind of explosive holiday season. The National Retail Federation, the nation's largest retail trade group, expects shoppers to spend more this year than last year, but their pace will slow given all the economic uncertainty. The group has forecast that U.S. holiday sales will rise 3-4% for November through December, compared with a 5.24% growth of a year ago. The pace is consistent with the average annual holiday increase of 3.6% from 2010 to pre-pandemic 2019. Americans ramped up spending during the pandemic with more money in their pockets from federal relief checks and nowhere to go during lockdowns. For the holiday 2021 season, sales for the 2-month period surged 12.7%. Many retailers had already ordered fewer goods for this holiday season and have pushed holiday sales earlier in October than last year to help shoppers spread out their spending. An early shopping push appears to be a trend that only got more pronounced during the pandemic, when clogs in the supply network in 2021 made people buy early for fear of not getting what they wanted. But retailers said that many shoppers will be focusing more on deals and will likely wait until the last minute. Best Buy said it's pushing more items at opening price points, while Kohl's has simplified its deals, promoting items under a certain price point, like $25, at its store. Online discounts should be better than a year ago, particularly for toys, electronics, and clothing, according to Adobe Analytics, which tracks online spending. It predicts toys will be discounted on average by 35%, compared with 22% a year ago, while electronics should see 30% cuts, compared with last year's 27%. In clothing, shoppers will see an average discount of 25%, compared with 19% last year, Adobe said. Analysts consider the five-day Black Friday weekend, which includes the Monday after the holiday known as Cyber Monday, a key barometer of shoppers' willingness to spend. And Black Friday is expected to be once again the busiest shopping day of the year, according to Sensormatic Solutions, a firm that tracks store traffic. On average, the top 10 busiest shopping days in the U.S. are expected to once again account for roughly 40% of all holiday retail traffic, Sensormatic said. Stores have been increasingly pushing Black Friday-type deals all month, helping to perk up business. Adobe Analytics reported that from November 1st through Monday, consumers spent $63.2 billion online, up 5% compared with the year-ago period and outpacing its estimate of 4.8% for the two-month holiday period. However, Marshall Cohen, chief retail advisor at Circana, a market research firm, said he thinks that shoppers will just stick to a list and not buy on impulse. He also believes they will take their time buying throughout the season. There's no sense of urgency, Cohen said. The consumers are saying, I will shop when it's convenient for me. That brings us to an article entitled, Illness Spikes in China. Potential for global outbreak after COVID prompts rare request. This comes from Jamie Keaton and Maria Cheng of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Geneva. Chinese officials say they did not detect any unusual or novel diseases in the country, the World Health Organization said Thursday following an official request by the UN Health Agency for information about a potentially worrying spike in respiratory illness and clusters of pneumonia in children. WHO cited unspecified media reports and a global infectious disease monitoring service as reporting clusters of undiagnosed pneumonia in children in northern China, and formally requested more details from China earlier this week. Outside scientists said the situation warranted close monitoring, but were not convinced that the recent spike in respiratory illnesses in China signaled the start of a new global outbreak. The emergence of new flu strains or other viruses capable of triggering pandemics typically starts with undiagnosed clusters of respiratory illness. Both SARS and COVID-19 were first reported as unusual types of pneumonia. WHO noted that authorities at China's National Health Commission on November the 13th reported an increase in respiratory diseases, which they said was due to the lifting of COVID-19 lockdown restrictions. Other countries also saw a jump in respiratory diseases such as respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, when pandemic restrictions ended. WHO said media reports about a week later reported clusters of undiagnosed pneumonia in children in northern China. The UN agency said it held a teleconference with Chinese health officials Thursday, during which the data it requested were provided. Those showed an increase in hospital admissions of children due to diseases including bacterial infection, RSV, influenza, and common cold viruses since October. Dr. Paul Hunter, a professor of medicine at Britain's University of East Anglia, doubted the wave of infections was sparked by a new disease. If it was a new disease, I would expect to see many more infections in adults, he said in a statement. The few infections reported in adults suggest existing immunity from a prior exposure. Francois Belot of University College London, said China was probably experiencing a significant wave of childhood infections since this was the first winter since lockdown restrictions were lifted, which likely reduced children's immunity to common bugs. WHO said that northern China has reported a jump in influenza-like illnesses since mid-October compared to previous 3 years. It is rare for the UN Health Agency to publicly ask for more detailed information from countries, as such requests are typically made internally. According to internal accounts in China, the outbreaks have swamped some hospitals in northern China, including in Beijing. The average number of patients in the internal medicine department at Beijing Children's Hospital topped 7,000 per day, exceeding the hospital's capacity, state-owned China National Radio said. Our next article is entitled, U.S. Celebrates on Edge Over War. Pro-Palestinian protest disrupts iconic parade. Biden's offer greetings. This comes from Lisette Cruz of the Associated Press, and the dateline is New York. Beloved characters like Snoopy and SpongeBob SquarePants soared through the skies above New York City on Thursday, and bands marched along the streets below as the annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade ushered in the holiday season. The parade started on Manhattan's Upper West Side, making its way alongside Central Park in front of big crowds and a national television audience before ending in front of Macy's flagship store on 34th Street. The parade was briefly disrupted when about a half dozen protesters in jumpsuits covered in fake blood glued themselves to the street just in front of a float carrying characters from the fast food chain McDonald's. They carried a banner that said, "Free Palestine," and "Genocide then, genocide now," and were taken into custody. The parade continued as police worked. Among the big names performing was Cher, who just released her first Christmas album. The Oscar, Emmy, and Grammy Award winner had a prime spot performing just before the arrival of Santa Claus, which marks the end of the parade. Other celebrities and musical groups taking part included Jon Batiste, Belle Biv DeVoe, Brandy, Jesse James Decker, Pentatonix, and Miss America 2023, Grace Stanky. The parade also included performances from the casts of some Broadway shows. New balloons debuting this year include Leo the Lizard, a character from a Netflix film who is more than 40 feet tall, as well as ones that have been there before, like SpongeBob, coming in at 44 feet. Some characters, like Snoopy, have been in the parade for many years, but this year's balloon is a new Beagle Scout Snoopy version, celebrating the 50th anniversary of his first appearance in the Peanuts comics. The parade isn't just about what's going on in the skies, though. At street level, the procession includes more than two dozen floats, interspersed with marching bands from around the country, and a number of clown crews among the 8,000 people participating, organizers said. Thousands lined the streets in coats on a chilly, sunny morning. Children were on the shoulders of their parents, shouting as characters like Bluey and Big Bird from Sesame Street passed by. Ross Greenstein drove 10 hours from Michigan to catch the parade with his daughter, who is studying law in New York, as well as his wife and two other children. Before Thursday, he had only seen the parade on TV. "I grew up every Thanksgiving waking up and jumping on the couch and watching the parade," Greenstein said. "We came to see the parade for the first time in my life, and it feels very surreal." This is the 97th time the parade has been held since the year 1924. The broadcast is hosted by Savannah Guthrie, Hoda Kotb, and Al Roker from Today and airs on NBC. President Joe Biden and his wife Jill called NBC during the parade. The president told Al Roker that people should take a moment to be thankful to live in a country with so much. "We're the greatest nation in the world. We should focus on that. We should focus on dealing with our problems and stop the rancor," Biden said. Report says moment of truth nearing for oil, gas industries. The title of our next article, planet warming sector must be cut quickly to save climate, IEA warns. This is written by Sibi Arasu of the Associated Press. The oil and gas sector, one of the major emitters of planet warming gases, will need a rapid and substantial overhaul for the world to avoid even worse extreme weather events fueled by human-caused climate change, according to a report released Thursday. The current investment of $800 billion a year in the oil and gas sector will need to be cut in half, and greenhouse emissions which result from the burning of fossil fuels like oil, will need to fall by 60% to give the world a fighting chance to meet its climate goals, the International Energy Agency said. Greenhouse gases go up into the atmosphere and heat the planet, leading to several impacts, including extreme weather events. The IEA's report comes just ahead of the United Nations Climate Conference, or COP28, which begins next week. Oil and gas companies, as well as other people and organizations connected to fossil fuels, often attend the meeting, drawing criticism from environmentalists and climate experts. But others say the sector needs to be at the table to discuss how to transition to cleaner energy. The oil and gas industry is facing a moment of truth at COP28 in Dubai. Fatih Birol, executive director of the IEA, said in a statement, "Oil and gas producers need to make profound decisions about their future place in the global energy sector. The energy sector is responsible for over two-thirds of all human activity related to greenhouse gas emissions, and oil and gas is responsible for about half of those, according to the IEA. Oil and gas companies are also responsible for over 60% of methane emissions." Now here's some short articles under the Digest heading. Russian cluster bomb attack kills three in Ukraine. A Russian attack using cluster munitions killed three people Thursday in a suburb of Ukraine's southern city of Kherson, a Ukrainian official said, bringing the number of civilians to die in a day of war to at least six. Five people were wounded in what Ukrainian Interior Minister Ihor Klimenko said was heavy afternoon shelling of Kherson's suburb. More than 60 residential and infrastructure buildings were damaged in the daylight attack, he said. Cluster munitions, a type of bomb that opens in the air and releases smaller bomblets across a wide area, are used by both Russia and Ukraine, which has received them as military aid from the United States. Meanwhile, Russian state media reported that TV journalist Boris Maksudovo died after being wounded in a drone attack while working in southern Ukraine's Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia region. Next, Hezbollah hits Israel with barrage of rockets. The militant Hezbollah group fired more than 50 rockets at military posts in northern Israel on Thursday, a day after Israeli airstrike on a home in southern Lebanon killed five of the group's senior fighters. The wave of rockets sent over the border represented one of the most intense bombardments since Hezbollah started attacking Israeli posts in the country's north at the beginning of the Israel-Hamas war. Hezbollah has said that by heating up its actions on the Israeli-Lebanon border, it is easing pressure on the Gaza Strip. Hezbollah released at least 21 statements claiming attacks on Thursday alone, making it a one-day record since fighting began last month. And under the briefly heading, mall crash. A pilot who died when the small plane he was flying crashed and burned on the doorstep of a strip mall in Texas was aborting a landing, according to a report Wednesday. The National Transportation Safety Board is still investigating. Ireland stabbings. Violent clashes broke out in Dublin on Thursday evening after a five-year-old girl was seriously injured in a knife attack earlier in the day that also saw a woman and two young children hospitalized. Hamas raids. Hundreds of police searched the properties of Hamas members and followers in Germany on Thursday following a formal ban on activity by or in support of the militant group, which has around 450 members in the country. From Ecuador, Daniel Noboa, an inexperienced politician and heir to a fortune built on the banana trade, was sworn in as president in Ecuador on Thursday and faces demands to restore public safety from drug cartels and other criminal organizations. Migrant influx. The European Union's border agency said Thursday it will send dozens of officers and equipment as reinforcements to Finland to help police its borders amid suspicion that Russia is behind an influx of migrants arriving in the country. And SWIFT concert. Authorities in Rio de Janeiro have launched an investigation of Time for Fun, the company behind Taylor Swift's sheltering Brazil show, including the one where a fan died November the 17th amid intense heat. Time for Fun CEO Seraphim Abreu posted a video apology on Thursday. You're listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we'll move on to sports, and the top story is entitled Love Leads Packers to Win Over Lions. It's written by Larry Lage of the Associated Press. Jordan Love dropped back and threw deep on his first snap, taking advantage of what Green Bay Packers thought the Detroit Lions defense would give them. They were right. Love set the tone with a 53-yard pass to Christian Watson on the game's first play and finished with a career-tying 3 touchdowns, leading Green Bay to a 29-22 win over the NFC North leading Lions on Thursday. It was something we put in this week that we thought was going to work, said Love, who had to reassure coach Matt LaFleur to stick with the first call when he had second thoughts about it on the morning of the game. We were confident in it. The Packers, with a record of 5-6, were in control of a game they never trailed, taking advantage of Jared Goff's career-high three fumbles, returning one for a score in the second quarter, and Dan Campbell's aggressiveness on fourth down. The Lions, with a record of 8-3, went for it 5 times on fourth down and only converted once on the final touchdown drive. One of the failed attempts was a risky decision to fake a punt with a run from their 23 in the third quarter, down by 9 points. That obviously was a very critical play in the game, LaFleur said, and that translated into a touchdown. 3 plays after the failed fake, Love threw a 16-yard touchdown pass to Watson to give Green Bay the 29-14 lead. Campbell later lamented the decision. "It's a bad call," Campbell said. "I shouldn't have done that to those guys." Goff pulled Detroit within 7 points with a 12-yard touchdown pass to Josh Reynolds and a 2-point conversion pass to Sam Laporta with 41 seconds left, but couldn't get closer 4 days after rallying from a 12-point deficit in the last few minutes in a comeback win over Chicago. The Lions were called for an illegal formation when they attempted an onside kick, a fitting end for them on an afternoon that started poorly and didn't get much better to deflate what was a fired-up crowd. "I didn't have my guys ready to go, bottom line," Campbell said. Love was 22 of 32 for 268 yards with 3 touchdowns, including 2 in the first quarter to rookies Jaden Reed and Tucker Kraft. He had a career-long 37-yard run on a read option play on third down late in the fourth quarter to seal the win. Rashawn Gary led Green Bay's dominant performance on defense. He forced a career-high 2 fumbles, recovering one of them, and tied a career high with 3 sacks and 7 tackles on the same field where the former Michigan star tore knee ligaments last season. Gary was in tears as LaFleur gave him a ball in the locker room. "Throughout this whole time, there's been a lot of emotion," Gary said. "I was praying, trying to keep my head cool." Goff finished 29 of 44 for 332 yards with 2 touchdowns, including 1 on a 7-yard pass to Laporta on the Lions' first drive. His 3 fumbles, though, doomed Detroit's chances. Jonathan Owens returned 1 of Goff's turnovers, 27 yards for a score that gave Green Bay a 20-6 lead in the opening quarter, getting some appreciation from his wife, Olympic gold medal winning gymnast Simone Biles, on social media. In Detroit's previous game against Chicago, Goff threw 3 interceptions for the first time in 3 seasons with the franchise. "Sometimes there is an answer, sometimes there isn't," he said. "Overall, it's my job to take care of the football." LaFleur was running off the field at halftime when a Ford Field security officer was in his way and put 2 hands on him as they briefly collided. "There might have been illegal contact," he joked. "It wasn't a big deal." The Lions, who were booed by their fans at times, have lost 7 straight games on Thanksgiving. In another NFL game, Cowboys beat Commanders for 13th straight win at home. It's written by Skylar Dixon of the Associated Press. Dak Prescott and his right guard Zach Martin feasted on a turkey leg together on the sideline with 6 minutes left in the game after the star quarterback's fourth touchdown pass. Then, Daron Bland really got the Thanksgiving party started for Dallas. Bland set an NFL record with his fifth interception return for a touchdown this season, and the Cowboys extended their longest home winning streak in 42 years to 13 by pulling away for a 45-10 victory over the Washington Commanders on Thursday. Dallas Cowboys' lead going into the fourth quarter was less than two touchdowns for the first time in five home games this season, but the Cowboys, with a record of 8-3, ended up tying a 55-year-old franchise record with the seventh victory by at least 20 points this season. The outcome was already set when Bland's fifth pick six punctuated a 25-point fourth quarter and interrupted Prescott's sideline feast. Didn't see him initially pick it, but I just heard the crowd erupt. Looked up and saw 26 had the ball in his hands, Prescott said. At that point, I just sprinted to the sideline to get a good view. A Dallas defense that gave up more than 200 yards for the first time in three games stiffened at key points in the second half, stopping Washington on fourth down three times. Sam Howell threw for 300 yards and had a rushing touchdown, but was sacked at his 24-yard line on fourth down early in the fourth quarter, setting up CeeDee Lamb's touchdown and two-point conversion catches for a 21-point Dallas lead. The Commanders, with a record of 4-8, lost for the eighth time in 10 games since a 2-0 start and dropped to 2-9 as the most common Thanksgiving opponent for their NFC rivals. "We just got beat by a lot of points on Thanksgiving," receiver Terry McLaurin said. "The game was within reach, and we just didn't make the necessary plays to kind of put the ball in the end zone and do our part. So that's never a good feeling." And in the third NFL game on Thanksgiving, San Francisco defeated Seattle 31-13. And the article is entitled "McCaffrey's Big First Half Carries 49ers Over Seahawks." It's written by Tim Booth of the Associated Press. Christian McCaffrey rushed for 114 yards and two touchdowns in the first half, and the San Francisco 49ers built a 21-point lead by halftime, rolling to a 31-13 win over the Seattle Seahawks on Thursday night. The 49ers, with a record of 8-3, won their fourth straight against their division rivals and have a two-game lead over Seattle in the NFC West. San Francisco won its third straight following a three-game losing streak and picked up its 10th straight win against an NFC West opponent. McCaffrey was terrific, running through arm tackles and breaking off a handful of big plays. McCaffrey rushed for touchdowns of 8 and 1 yards as the 49ers built a 24-3 halftime advantage. Deebo Samuel also ran for a 2-yard touchdown on San Francisco's opening possession, and Brock Purdy was nearly flawless in the first half, completing 15 of 20 passes. Purdy threw an interception that was returned for a touchdown early in the third quarter, but avoided any other miscues and put a cap around the victory with a 28-yard scoring pass to Brandon Ayuk with 7:51 left that sent some Seahawk fans headed for the exits. Purdy finished 21 of 30 for 209 yards, and while he wasn't perfect like last week against Tampa Bay, he outplayed the quarterback on the other side. Seattle's Geno Smith was playing banged up after leaving last Sunday's loss to the Los Angeles Rams in the second half with an injury in his right arm near his elbow. He'll have more bumps and bruises after the 49ers finished with him. Smith was 18 of 27 for 180 yards. He was sacked six times, threw an interception in the first half, and nearly had a few more throws picked off. Seattle's first five possessions gained 15 total yards, and when Seattle tried to rally in the second half, Smith took a couple of untimely sacks. Smith also ran to argue with an official after there was no flag for defensive holding or pass interference on a throw intended for Jackson, Smith, and Jigba in the end zone that would have given Seattle first and goal late in the third quarter. Seattle settled for a field goal and never threatened again. Seattle's last chance at a rally ended when Zach Charbonnet was stopped on fourth and one at the San Francisco 21 with 4 minutes and 14 seconds remaining. The Seattle Seahawks, with a record of 6-5, lost for the second time in 5 days and have dropped three of the last four. In college football, number 12 Ole Miss shuts down Mississippi State in the Egg Bowl. This is written by Robbie Falk of the Associated Press. The dateline is Starkville, Mississippi. Quinshon Judkins rushed for 119 yards and a touchdown, and number 12 Mississippi clamped down on defense to beat rival Mississippi State 17-7 on Thursday night in their annual battle for the Golden Egg. Jackson Dart threw a 26-yard touchdown pass to Caden Pricecorn early in the fourth quarter to give the Rebels a 10-point lead. Judkins scored on a 2-yard run in the third to put Ole Miss ahead 10-7. Will Rogers passed for 207 yards and scored on a 1-yard plunge that gave the Bulldogs an advantage with 8:33 left in the third. But a targeting penalty on MSU linebacker Deshaun Page kept the ensuing drive alive, and the Rebels went 75 yards in 10 plays to regain the lead when Judkins punched it in. The road team has won 6 of the past 8 Golden Egg matchups. Ole Miss was shut out in the first quarter for the first time this season and was held to just a field goal in the first half, but the Rebels went into the locker room with a 3-0 lead despite being held to a season low for points in any half. Caden Costa kicked a 36-yard field goal for Mississippi in the second quarter to cap a 66-yard drive that took 13 plays and 6 minutes and 22 seconds. Mississippi State drove 71 yards for a touchdown in 4 minutes and 55 seconds on its first possession of the second half. Ole Miss finished with only 307 yards of total offense and was held below 100 yards of passing as Dart finished 14 of 26 for 96 yards and a touchdown. Judkins carried 28 times and became the third Rebels running back to eclipse 1,000 yards twice in a career. The Bulldogs had a 303 yards of offense. Rogers completed 25 of 39 passes and had his second career rushing touchdown. MSU averaged just 3.4 yards per carry. Ole Miss won 10 regular season games for the second time in 3 years. Before the arrival of coach Lane Kiffin, the Rebels never had a 10-win regular season. Mississippi State finished a tumultuous year dating back to December of 2022. Bulldogs coach Mike Leach died shortly after the 2022 regular season, and the school fired new coach Zach Arnett this year before finishing 5-7. In NBA news, Magic serve homeless coalition before tourney game versus Celtics. This comes from the Orlando Sentinel. For more than 30 years, the Orlando Magic have spent the morning of Thanksgiving serving breakfast to the residents at the Coalition for the Homeless of Central Florida. Orlando rookie Anthony Black was able to partake in the tradition for the first time Thursday and could feel the difference he was making for children in the community. It's just cool knowing that talking to these kids, it impacts them and they'll remember for a while, he said. They were joking around saying that they get served by an NBA player every year. It's pretty cool that those small conversations mean something. Black was joined by head coach Jamal Mosley, president of basketball operations Jeff Weltman, CEO Alex Martins, Magic community ambassador Bo Outlaw, and vice president of shareholder engagement Ryan DeVos, who was representing the DeVos family at the event. "We don't even look at it as giving up our own morning," Weltman said. "We look at it as they're allowing us in because it's a really special way for us to start the day every year." The breakfast, which was paid for by Mosley, has allowed the Magic to serve a nutritious breakfast for the 31st year to individuals and families struggling with homelessness who rely on the coalition for their meals. "There are so many things to be thankful for," Mosley said, "just the ability to give back and to share. The fact that we're so blessed to have the ability to bless those who don't have as many things." Although basketball wasn't the focus Thursday morning, Mosley has a lot to be thankful for on the court, too. His young squad has won 5 games in a row, the longest winning streak in the East, which includes Wednesday's 5-point triumph over defending NBA champion Denver at Amway Center. The Magic have their best record through 15 games since the 2011-2012 season when they began 11-4. Friday's home game against the Boston Celtics is Orlando's final group play matchup in in-season tournament. If the Celtics win, they win the East Group C. The Magic are in need of a win to remain in contention for the knockout rounds. Boston has won 7 of its last 8 games. Orlando, which also has beaten Milwaukee by 15 and the LA Lakers by 19, feels confident entering the game. "We want to be a great team," Paolo Banchero said after Wednesday's win. "The coaches can only do so much, so we have to step up as players. We can't let each other be flustered out there." In the NHL, Blackhawks Hall has knee surgery. Blackhawks forward Taylor Hall will have right knee surgery, likely sidelining the 2018 NHL MVP for the rest of the season. The team placed Hall and forward Andreas Alhanasu on injured reserve on Thursday. The move with Alhanasu, who has a groin injury, was made retroactive to November the 9th. Forwards Joey Anderson and Cole Gutman were recalled from Rockford of the American Hockey League. Last place Chicago has dropped five in a row heading into Friday's matchup against Toronto. The 32-year-old Hall, who was selected by Edmonton with the number one overall pick in the 2010 NHL draft, was acquired in a trade with Boston right before Chicago took Connor Bedard with a top pick in this year's draft. Hall was brought in to help provide some leadership and scoring alongside Bedard, but he was hampered by a left shoulder injury. Hall's knee injury occurred when he was hit by Tampa Bay's Michael Essiemont on November the 9th. He returned last weekend at Nashville and played two games before he missed Wednesday night's 7-3 loss at Columbus. Hall has two goals and two assists in 10 games this season. He has 266 goals and 433 assists in 14 seasons, also playing for Edmonton, New Jersey, Boston, Arizona, and Buffalo. And Anaheim became the fourth team in the past 30 years to have four players under the age of 21 all record a point in the same game. Mason McTavish, Tristan Lanoue, Leo Carlson, and Pavel Mintyukov all recorded one in the Ducks' 4-3 loss to Montreal on Wednesday. Now here's an article entitled, What's Pushing Inflation Down? More goods, workers, and housing are steering prices lower. It's written by Christopher Ruggeber of the Associated Press. Long past its painful peak, inflation in the United States may be heading steadily back toward its pre-pandemic levels without the need for further interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve. Such a scenario became more likely, if hardly guaranteed, after November 14th's surprisingly tame report on consumer prices for October. The Labor Department's data showed a broad-based easing of inflation across most goods and services. The price of gas? Down. Appliances? Down. Autos? Down. Same for airfares, hotel rooms, and doctor's fees. Overall inflation didn't rise from September to October, the first time that consumer prices collectively haven't budged from one month to another in more than a year. Compared with a year earlier, prices rose 3.2% in October, the smallest such rise since June, though still above the Fed's 2% inflation target. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, so-called core inflation was just 0.2% last month, slightly below the pace of the previous 2 months. Measured year over year, core prices rose 4% in October, down from 4.1% in September, the smallest rise in 2 years. The inflation fever has broken, said Bill Adams, chief economist at Comerica Bank. Rising petroleum production is holding down gas prices. House prices are rising more slowly after mortgage rates surged in 2023, and rents are also rising more gradually as more apartment buildings are completed. October's milder-than-expected price figures make it much less likely that the Fed will impose another rate hike. Many economists now say that the Fed's most likely next move will be to cut rates, likely sometime next year, though that would depend on whether inflation continues to cool. A major factor has been a big improvement in supply of many things, workers, housing, and components for manufacturing goods. Millions of Americans have come off the sidelines in the past year and flooded back into the workforce, seeking and mostly finding jobs. Immigration has increased too, and with it, more people looking for work. With more hires available, businesses haven't had to raise wages as much to fill jobs, thereby easing the pressure on those businesses to raise their prices. At some time, the largest number of new apartment buildings nationwide in decades are being completed, a trend that is helping slow rent increases. Rental costs, after a spike in September, rose at a much more gradual pace last month. Rents and other housing costs are likely to keep coming down, economists say, as the cost of new leases continues to fall, according to real-time data providers such as Zillow. Those lower prices show up in the government's data with a lag. And the supply chains that were badly snarled during the COVID-19 pandemic have pretty much unwound. Ample availability of products, parts, and components helps keep a lid on their prices. Automakers, for example, are having a much easier time finding semiconductors. Partly as a result, new car prices declined last month, defying fears that the now-settled autoworkers' strike would reduce dealers' inventories and send prices higher. Used car prices, too, are down. They fell for a fifth straight month in October and have tumbled 7% from a year ago. We're finally undoing that and getting the benefits, Austin Goolsbee, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, said Tuesday in remarks at the Detroit Economic Club. Separately, consumers are widely expected to pull back on spending after a blowout summer, with credit card debts and delinquencies rising and average savings falling. Cooler demand should force businesses to compete more on price. Gas costs have kept falling this month, with the national average price at the pump at $3.55 on November the 14th, down 42 cents from a year earlier. Those declines in prices could push overall inflation, measured year over year, below 3% by December. Yes, inflation is still painfully apparent in many areas. They include auto and health insurance and some groceries, such as beef and bread. The average cost of auto insurance, which jumped 1.9% just from September to October, has soared nearly 20% from a year earlier. As new and used vehicles have grown more expensive, so has the cost of insuring them. And health insurance prices rose 1.1% last month, though that was largely due to a change in the government's methodology. But even as overall price increases slow, it doesn't mean inflation is reversing or that most prices are falling back to pre-pandemic levels. The Consumer Price Index, the most widely followed measure of inflation, remains about 20% higher than it was before the pandemic. Milk prices, which have ticked down compared with the past year, are still 23% higher than they were pre-pandemic. Ground beef prices are 31% higher. Gas prices, despite a steep decline from a year ago, are still 46% higher than before the pandemic. Many economists say a key reason why so many Americans hold a gloomy view of the economy despite very low unemployment and steady hiring is that these prices on items they buy regularly remain much higher than they were 3 years ago. Barring a deep and painful recession, prices aren't going to fall to their pre-pandemic levels. Instead, economists say Americans' wages need to rise to help pay for the higher costs. Wages and salaries trailed inflation in 2021 and 2022, exacerbating the pain of higher prices. Yet this year, as inflation has cooled, average pay has pulled ahead of inflation. By most measures, average paychecks adjusted for inflation are back to where they were before the pandemic. Yet that essentially means that Americans on average have had scant real pay increases compared with 3 years ago, and while average pay may be back to pre-pandemic levels, many people have received below average pay raises and are still behind inflation. The Fed will likely welcome last Tuesday's report as evidence of further progress toward getting inflation back to its 2% target. Fed officials led by Chair Jerome Powell are considering whether their benchmark rate is high enough to quell inflation or if they need to impose another increase in coming months. Powell said recently that Fed officials were not confident that rates were sufficiently high to tame inflation. The Fed has raised its benchmark interest rate 11 times in the past year and a half to about 5.4%, the highest level in 22 years. But the central bank has raised its key rate just once since May. Since its last meeting on November 1st, a government report showed that hiring cooled in October compared with September, and wage growth slowed, easing pressure on companies to raise prices in the coming months. Adams, the Comerica economist, said he thinks the Fed's most likely next move will be to cut rates, likely by mid-2024. The Fed's rate hikes have increased the costs of mortgages, auto loans, credit cards, and many forms of business borrowing, part of a concerted drive to slow growth and cool inflation pressures. The central bank is trying to achieve a soft landing, raising borrowing costs just enough to curb inflation without tipping the economy into a deep recession. They look like they are on course to generate a soft landing, said Eric Winograd, chief economist at asset management firm AB Global. There's no guarantee that they will actually manage to accomplish it, but right now, that's the story that the data are telling. Now here's a letter from the Ask Amy column. Dear Amy, during the pandemic, I was diagnosed and treated for breast cancer. After my treatment was completed, my doctor prescribed medication that may reduce the recurrence of this cancer. These drugs have many different side effects. One of the side effects I am experiencing is weight loss. What do I say when someone says, oh, you've lost a lot of weight, looking great? If it is someone I know fairly well and I'm comfortable with them knowing about my health, I may have to tell them I have cancer. But when my mechanic mentioned my weight loss, I did not know what to say. I think I just smiled weakly. How would you reply in my situation? Signed, Recovering. Dear Recovering, honestly, I'd probably reply as you have done, because the comment, which is meant as a compliment, is actually loaded with subtext, leading you to wonder, for instance, if you didn't look so great before you became ill. You might honestly respond, well, I've been dealing with some health problems, but this would probably invite more inquiries and discussions about your health. This could be an opportunity to use the traditional Southern comeback. Here is how to deploy this nugget. You simply make eye contact and say, well, aren't you sweet? That brings us to the end of today's reading for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.